And welcome back to Coast. Scott Smith is going to be joining us in a moment. His latest work is called God Reconsidered. Scott was on with me some time ago when we talked about his incredible work called The Soul of Your Pet, Evidence for the Survival of Animals After Death, which was an amazing. We'll touch on that for a little bit later on in the program. But this work tonight, we'll talk about some case studies of ESP, UFOs, the afterlife as well, all put into the title of God Reconsidered. It's much broader than that, and we're going to be back in a moment with Scott on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Scott Smith with us, freelance business journalist, more than 1,200 published articles in 175 major media outlets. He has explored the soul of pets, as well as searching for the truth in the debate between atheism and religion. His latest work is called God Reconsidered. And Scott, welcome. You always seem to hit one out of the park. You did it again with this.
Thanks, George. Great to be back. And you're carrying the good word out to the world and keeping the idea alive that maybe there's something that we don't actually fully understand.
Ironically, I left L.A. a couple of weeks ago for my trip to St. Louis, and you've been to St. Louis. You used to work with Bevy Yeagers.
Oh, yeah. I interviewed a lot of police who had worked with her on murder. She was a very famous psychic medium. I started working on a book with her, and then we both kind of got distracted. But she was a very, very impressive psychometrist. She could touch something and get the images associated with it. And I talked to a lot of really hard-headed police who said, hey, we don't care how this happens. Somehow she's able to deliver us the results. So that was one of many remarkable people that I met during my career covering the paranormal before I actually got into the worldly stuff.
Yeah. Do you still write for Fate magazine?
Well, I haven't written in years or for UFO magazine or really a lot in the paranormal area, but I've been in touch with them. Maybe we'll do something again. This has really been the culmination of a lifelong search, and I started writing at probably about 6 years old. I was on my writing career and have covered the gamut, but this is definitely a departure from what I've been doing in business journalism the last 20 years.
And now, the title, God Reconsidered, I want you to tell us about the title.
So the concept is that it is possible to take a hard-headed journalistic approach to the paranormal and to religious issues and bring a little common sense to it. I was actually kind of surprised as I got immersed in the book that if you think clearly about the issues, there are many things that will help you make a decision as you're going through it. The problem is that most of us have a background in a particular spiritual tradition that really screens out problems, logical problems, or ethical issues. So I had also, way back, had started a conversation with what I call the professional debunkers. They like to refer to themselves as skeptics. You've had Michael Shermer on, for example.
Sure.
And so I began a long conversation with these people, sometimes in Fate, sometimes by mail and in other publications. And these people are not skeptics in the sense of trying to find the truth, making an honest effort. The Committee for Skeptical Inquiry and Shermer Skeptic Society are as irrational as any evangelical pastor that I've ever dealt with when it comes to the supernatural. They can't stand the idea that there isn't something that they can explain. And I just posted something about my book on a so-called skeptic website and had a really hysterical reaction to it. So I'm trying to encourage people to think objectively about this. There's a lot you can learn in the process, and I take people through my entire life spiritual search in the process. And people may not agree with me, but I think I shed some light on a lot of the related issues.
Was it difficult for you to make the transition
to being a more worldly journalist,
mm-hmm,
from the crazy stuff?
Yeah. the fun stuff?
Actually, the interesting thing is, you know, I back in kindergarten when kids came back from their summer vacation, we were supposed to do our report. Most kids wrote one sentence, and, you know, I turned in these 20 pages with, you know, the letters about an inch high and so forth. So I was kind of off and running and curious, and I grew up in a household where business success in Mormonism, and that was my background, is considered being a very hard-headed guy like Mitt Romney, you know, being a business success, and believing in daily miracles, the supernatural, they're not incompatible. Mormons view this world as just being a different dimension from the paranormal world. They're both completely real. It would be kind of like the way physicists see a multiverse, you know, where there are different dimensions. Now, most scientists aren't going to want to call that, you know, a paranormal universe, but Mormons take a kind of very materialist approach. So I was very well prepared in terms of being open-minded. Mormonism is very open to seeing the truth in other religions. And so when I grew up, the notion that, you know, the ancestors might come back and visit us, or angels, were just perfectly normal. And there was actually, you know, a lot of emphasis on being an entrepreneurial success. So it just so happened that, you know, I ended up covering the paranormal for a long time before I actually launched my business journalism career.
Well, I like the fact that in even the first chapter, you touch on the paranormal right away, and it's not a book about religion by any means, is it?
Yeah, what, you know, I am not a believer that you can prove God logically in the traditional religious arguments as the first mover, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I can respect those who are either agnostic or atheist. Where there's a problem, and this is what I address in the first three chapters, is what's called philosophical materialism, because that says there's nothing other than what we can see or touch. And I think the skeptics correctly, if rather subconsciously, realize that if they admit that something like even ESP, which Sigmund Freud, who is an atheist, believed in because he had a lot of telepathic experiences with his patients, but if they allow that, then it's a slippery slope to believing in all the crazy stuff like UFOs and afterlife and, God forbid, God. So I try to take a different approach and say, okay, let's not debate God, because that is a matter for mystical experience, which I've had, but I'm not bringing into this discussion, because I think first we have to determine if there is such a thing as the paranormal. So I take three test cases and I put them under the lens of a little logic to see if, in fact, you can come up with some evidence for these things. And I think for most people who aren't well versed in this, it's surprising how much solid evidence there is for the supernatural. And this is why the skeptics are a little freaked out about my book.
Do you think that in the beginning, when I sound like Genesis, that they were really talking about extraterrestrial events as opposed to godlike events? Fallen angels, for example. To me, it sounds like you're talking about ETs that came down here.
Yeah, well, I've interviewed Zechariah Sitchin, who has a whole series of books along that line, and he certainly makes the case that the Sumerians and others have reacted and maybe built religions around these interactions. And for a Mormon, that's not a problem. And I was growing up, we believed that there were people from other planets who came here and other dimensions. You know, it wasn't really that unusual. And I will also say that the great parapsychologist Scott Rogo, who wrote a whole bunch of books, and this started my career with Fate Magazine, as I interviewed him a few weeks before he was murdered. But he has had a book called Miracles, which shows very clearly that spirits are promoting religion, you know, up until today, the Marian Visions, for example, which seem to promote the Catholic Church. I've been in a lot of Islamic countries. I've been a travel writer. I spent a week in Riyadh. I have no doubt that Muhammad received a visitation from a spirit who called himself the Angel Gabriel. So ETs, or whatever they are, perhaps they're an interdimensional phenomenon, have been involved with religion and promoting religion from the beginning of mankind.
For their benefit, or what do you think their motivation was?
Well, it's still going on today. I mean, Harold Bloom wrote a couple of books, The American Religion and Omens of the Millennium, in which he argues that Mormonism was unique in that Joseph Smith was able to allow other people to see the angels of his visions and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so if you listen to Sitchin, they had malicious intention kind of to hypnotize or trap people into being their slaves psychically and otherwise. But I think to a certain extent, the shamans have always said that there are benevolent spirits, do you want to quote, there are malevolent ones who mean us harm, and then there are those that are just kind of lost souls. So I think to a certain extent, the spirits want to be worshipped, or maybe in some cases they want to promote what they regard as an ethical life through religion. There are a lot of reasons for it. When I started researching the abduction phenomenon with UFOs, I decided that most of these spirits were not well-intentioned, and that's a whole world unto itself, and that really caused one of my first spiritual crises, because even though Mormons were open to the idea of visitors from other planets, and they also believed in malevolent spirits, the abduction phenomenon was much spookier and really led to me to have a kind of a spiritual nervous breakdown when I tried to confront the implications. And that led to my first mystical experience in 1989, which was kind of the trigger that led up to this book all these years later.
Is that what literally got you into the paranormal world?
Yeah, I mean, other than my Mormon background, the thing that's unusual about Mormonism that kind of overlaps this idea of the Greek word of gnosis, or kind of direct knowledge or insight, is that Mormons believe anybody can get a direct revelation from God. My friend Mark Coltco Rivera wrote a book a few years ago called The Rise of the Mormons, in which he shows that it has so many compelling aspects to it, including being a religion with a lot of supernatural manifestations, that it is on its way over the next century to becoming the next great world religion. So when you grow up with this milieu of the real supernatural, I think that opened you up to having mystical experiences. And I had just gone through the Landmark Forum, which used to be called EST, in 1988 when I was studying UFOs for the first time. And I think the kind of the psychological pressure of that triggered this experience where for a couple of hours I was in a definitely physically altered state and had access to direct knowledge of what I call the great lie that is the foundation for most religions, which is that a benevolent God created this world for our good so that we could exercise our free will and make moral progress and go back to heaven. That's kind of the summary of the essence of religions East and West. And I didn't know what that meant at the time. I'd never heard of anything like this. And so that launched my career in Fate magazine and UFO magazine, writing about the paranormal. And I had a chance to do this last interview with Scott Rogo, covering all these different issues. And I asked him in the interview something that had intrigued me. Mormons believed animals had spirits, but this was a time in the late 80s with all these books on near-death experiences. Nobody ever mentioned animals. So I asked him, what do you think? Has there ever been anybody who's seen animals on the other side? And he said, yeah, he told me about a particular incident, and that led to the writing of my second book, which was The Soul of Your Pet. And the first version came out in 1994, and then I was off and running, interviewing people like Uri Geller and James Van Praagh.
Mm-hmm.
Traveled the whole world, participating in everything from Santeria ceremonies to Jain temple ceremonies, and writing about these things. And it was just a fantastic career. And then I got more practical, had to support a family, and went into the more worldly side of things.
Yeah, you've interviewed some top business leaders.
Yeah, it's been fun. And incidentally, it may surprise people, but virtually everybody that I've talked to has a spiritual path.
Do you ask them that?
I often do, because these typically will last 30 to 60 minutes, and I always like to ask kind of quirky questions like, you know, what was your greatest travel experience? What's your favorite novel? You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And we'll often get into psychology, and I'll say, well, have you ever been through psychotherapy, off the record, since nobody wants to be known as being nuts enough to have to, you know, go through that. And so it's remarkable how many great leaders really have an overarching philosophy. Many of them actually they had their bachelor's degree in philosophy, which is about like getting one in quantum physics. And it's way beyond my intellectual ability, but my son recently got a degree in philosophy, and it forces you to kind of rethink all your assumptions. But yeah, great leaders are great thinkers and readers, and they're very open-minded about stuff like this.
You find that there's a common denominator with those people, those very successful people?
Yeah, the thirst for knowledge would be number one, and secondly, the resilience. You have to overcome so many unexpected crises that it's no wonder that 90% of startups die, most in the first year, because the adversities that you run into as an entrepreneur are just would discourage any normal person. But, you know, most of them take kind of the long view. It's kind of like Thomas Edison, who said, well, I found, you know, the first 1,000 ways not to make the light bulb, you know. So these are people who are not like ordinary people. They have super resilience. They're super, super curious. And they're not closed-minded about anything, by and large, in my experience.
When you talk about UFOs and ghosts and life after death, what are you trying to convince the non-believers of? Its existence or what?
Well, the approach I took in my first three chapters that I kind of drill into this is that I just want people to take a more open-minded approach to subjects that they think are way off the deep end. And if they want to be a professed atheist or agnostic, that's fine. Nothing wrong as long as they're open-minded. What I object to is the modern militant skeptics' desire to silence public discussion about these things. In the opening chapter, I talk about Dean Radin's The Conscious Universe and the problems he went to trying to get this book reviewed, which was a very hard-headed scientific approach by a former Bell engineer to discuss the solid evidence for ESP. And, you know, as I think I mentioned, Freud believed in ESP. This doesn't have to be a paranormal thing, but these skeptics are so close-minded that, you know, if you read their magazines, they're against chiropractic, you know, magnetism.
Just about everything. We're going to come back, Scott, in a moment. I also want to spend some time talking about the previous book, The Soul of Your Pet. Everybody out here loves animals, so we'll check in with you on that. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with Scott Smith, author of God Reconsidered. We'll take your phone calls next hour. And, of course, Scott, I can't let this night go by without talking to you about the book we talked about years ago, The Soul of Your Pet, Evidence for the Survival of Animals. Curious what got you to write that book.
Well, it started out very casually because I was just interested in the fact that this was the time of Melvin Morris and the near-death experience bestsellers and so forth, and nobody ever mentioned animals on the other side. So I sent out letters to veterinary journals, magazines about the paranormal, and I asked people to send me any kind of experience that they thought was actually pretty credible, not just a ghost story. And I was surprised at the hundreds of letters I got back from people who said, listen, I've never had any crazy supernatural experience, but this is what made me a believer that animals have souls. And they would tell a story that had some element that made it credible. For example, there might have been multiple witnesses, you know, a whole family. They all see the same thing, which makes it a little bit harder to dismiss as a hallucination. I mean, the average skeptic would say, oh, your dog died, and of course, wishful thinking, you thought you saw it. But each of the stories that I got really had that core element. So I divided the stories or the experiences into that aspect of it. For example, I was living in Thousand Oaks, California, and there was a vet there who became a veterinary professor at Purdue, very hard-headed person, and she was once asked to go on a house call to treat an ill horse. And she gets there, and she examines the horse, and she says, you know something, this is contagious. You're going to need to separate this horse from the other one.
Well, they all get it, yeah.
You're right. And they said, there's just one problem. We don't have another horse. She said, well, what about this other one over here? And she described it, and they said, well, that horse died a few months ago. There's no horse there. I don't know. We don't know what you're talking about.
Jeez.
And even though she didn't even know that they had another horse before she got there and that it had died, she could see it. And this is actually becomes a common theme. People mentioning to their neighbor, well, I'm glad to see that your dog is up and well again, recovered from surgery. He seemed to be having a good time in the yard yesterday. What are you talking about? He died on the vet table, you know. So it was really amazing. And most amazing of all is that I had some stories where living pets reacted to the ghost animal. So it's not just human imagination. In one case, this gal was watching TV at night, her two living cats next to her on the couch, and a cat that had recently died came out, the ghost came out walking across the living room. The other two cats' backs hunched up, and the fur was up in the air, and they watched this ghost go right over to the bedroom door, walk through it. Then they jumped down, ran over to the door, and wouldn't go in the bedroom for months afterwards. So all of the stories in The Soul of Your Pet, which incidentally is having an afterlife of its own because it's still available on GodReconsidered.com and on Amazon and so forth. And I've had lots and lots and lots of people come up to me and say, you know, it was a very comforting book and I had a similar experience, but I never told anybody because I thought they would think I was crazy. So I think this is actually a very common experience. And, you know, we've been too arrogant to acknowledge the fact that some of, at least the higher animals, have souls just like people do.
A lot of people, and you're going to get some phone calls next hour when we open up the phone lines, witness seeing things like a dead cat that passed on. They'll see the paw prints walking on the bed. They won't see the cat, but they'll see the indentations of the paw prints.
Yes.
To me, that's amazing evidence.
It's surprising to me, too. I didn't expect that one, but quite often they will hear the animal purr. They could even touch it, or they'll feel the animal cuddle up against them, but it's not a conventional ghost. And there were a lot of ones like that that came in. I was very surprised at the quality and variety of evidence, you know, this is just one. I was really the first one to come out with this. There have been a couple of books since then. Brad Steiger,
Yes, no, Brad Well.
Yeah, and you know, he gave me some guidance on, you know, how to put together the book and the sort of thing. So, you know, there's a tremendous amount that we human beings are just too arrogant to acknowledge. And I don't know why the skeptics are so close-minded. I mean, don't we think 1,000 years from now we're going to uncover all kinds of things that we right now think are just crazy, you know? So we're just babes in the woods. And for those of us who are open-minded, it's kind of fun to discover these things.
At what level does a living entity not have a soul? I mean, how... on the chain of things, do birds have souls? Do hamsters have souls? Do ants have souls?
Well, I'm praying the cockroaches don't make
or mosquitoes.
Yeah, it's a great question. Now, the Mormons have had this teaching that all consciousness has been there all the time. It's eternal, coexistence with the gods, and their job is to develop it and embody it. So you know, we don't fully understand what spirit is. And we, of course, we know, and Scott Rogo actually was a practitioner of this, that people can leave their bodies, astral projection. So exactly what the relationship is to the body and the soul in humans and animals and kind of where maybe this gets into a group soul or something, I don't know. I'm very conservative in my arguments because, you know, I think that there are a lot of things that are probably true, but they're a little harder for us to grasp or explain. So I just argue that animals survive death. They get to the other side. What happens after death, you know, whether they go to heaven, reincarnate, or whatever, that's more speculative. But I do think there's pretty hard evidence for animal survival, of at least the higher animals, as far as we can tell so far. I didn't get any ant stories, but I did get a few bird stories, and so they made the cut anyway.
During reincarnation, the process of reincarnation, can an animal end up as a human and a human an animal?
Well, I'm actually quite skeptical about reincarnation.
Are you? How come?
There are a number of reasons for it. Scott Rogo wrote a book called The Search for Yesterday, in which he shows that most of the anecdotal evidence can be easily explained as a trick of the brain, like a dream, and so forth. I have a much bigger problem, actually not with reincarnation per se, which could be driven by an attachment to the world, but it doesn't really work under karma for a lot of reasons. But the simple answer is that in order for one individual's karma to work out to a specific destiny, you'd have to freeze the whole universe. The whole universe would have to revolve around that individual's free will so that they don't die ahead of their karmic destiny and so forth. And I make some, I think, what are very good arguments. A lot of people in my current faith, which is Christian Gnosticism, would disagree. It's not a dogma one way or the other. Now, to the extent that reincarnation may exist or it may happen kind of sporadically, depending on certain circumstances, trauma or attachment to the world and so forth, I see no reason why spirits can't evolve. The Mormons are in theory open to that. There's no explicit teachings, but they say animals can progress just like human beings in the hereafter when we die. That's just the first step in a cosmic evolution. So we're just a fairly brief candle in the dark with this current existence.
The animals in question, when you wrote the book, The Soul of Your Pet, you know, you look at the Omen, and they had that Rottweiler there with the red eyes. Do those kinds of animals come back, too?
You know, I would say that, first of all, the thing to know is that animals have the same intelligence type and range of emotion as people. Anybody who has a pet knows that pets have completely different personalities, and there can be nasty, evil, neurotic dogs that I've known, you know, and a person's personality might determine either whether they come back or what happens to them in the next life. Joseph Smith, the Mormon founder, taught that, you know, there are heavenly beasts, that the allegorical seeming figures in the book of Revelation in the Bible actually were literal animals. So who's to say if other planets are peopled by strange creatures that might look to us like animals? I think we ought to be a little humble about what might be. I mean, you know, who are we who have had civilization for 5,000 years to say that in the eternities there aren't species that are much more advanced to us than us and aren't even human? I mean, our arrogance and closed-mindedness, and this is why I just fundamentally object to the so-called skeptics who are not skeptical in the sense of being open-minded and wanting to test things. They're just debunkers of anything that they don't think fits in their little Newtonian box. And I think we can learn a lot by just saying, you know something, reality's a lot stranger than anybody thought. And the interesting thing is that most of the great names in quantum physics, starting with Einstein, did believe in a God who is behind the order of the universe. It's not your standard personal God like Jesus or something, but they were actually very devout believers in a divine presence.
What have we learned? What have you learned about what you think the other side is? And have you ever had doubts that it existed, ever?
Yes. I did have doubts when I was going through my spiritual crisis in the 1980s and 90s. I wasn't sure what to believe when I had my little mystical experience. I was kind of falling apart with a spiritual nervous breakdown because for my first 29 years, I knew about the supernatural evidence for Mormonism, or that's used to support the idea that it's the true religion. But what really was the truth about the other side? I didn't know. I asked Scott Rogo, who had written 30 books when I interviewed him, and brilliant, the greatest parapsychologist of all time, in my opinion. I said, what do you think the big answers are? What do you think the overarching truth is about afterlife and religion and so forth? And he said, you know something? I'm more confused than I was when I started my research. So I ended up eventually embracing Gnostic Christianity. But for sure, the universe is vastly more interesting and complicated, multidimensional. I think that the UFO thing, for example, is probably partly paranormal, partly extraterrestrial, and that we have the next 100 or 1,000 years are going to be fascinating, and it will overthrow a lot of our assumptions about the nature of reality.
Both of your books seem to mesh together, The Soul of Your Pet and God Reconsidered. There's a tie-in there, isn't there?
Well, first of all, I tried to take a very methodical, journalistic type of approach to both of them. You're trained to think objectively and analyze things like a legal case. So when I talk about evidence, I don't mean laboratory evidence, although there is a lot of that for ESP and some of the other things. But I wanted to take a common sense approach that a person who wasn't biased would read the testimony about all these different wild topics and say, hey, this really isn't that nuts. There actually are experiences that our little rational minds can't fully explain, and they deserve to be investigated further. And that's what I would say about afterlife, UFOs, ESP, animal souls. Why don't we really concentrate on trying to come up with some more evidence and answers? And I think I'm only half joking when I've talked to James Van Praagh and Uri Geller. I said, why don't you guys leave your body, go into the afterlife, and come back and tell me what you learned, and I'll write a book about it, and we'll really get this down. And I was amused when the great medium George Anderson once asked the spirits about reincarnation. He said, is it a real thing? And the spirits told him, well, we've heard about it, but we're not sure. So if you're already dead and you're not sure, then there are many mysteries even after we die.
It is remarkable how it all works, isn't it, Scott?
It it's a lot of fun, and your show's apparently going to go on for eternity trying to get to the bottom of all this.
When skeptics tell you, show me the proof, show me the evidence.
I'll tell you.
Some of this has got to be on faith, right?
Well, you know something, there's a lot of things that you can prove, and ESP is one of them. And Dean Radin's The Conscious Universe is footnoted, and he says, you know something, experimenters in psychic phenomena no longer are trying to prove that some of these things like ESP and psychokinesis, which is moving objects with the mind, that they exist. I mean, there's so many thousands of double-blind experiments. They've moved on to practical applications. Dean Radin moved to Silicon Valley. He's been working on technology projects. But the skeptics are not, in fact, skeptical in the sense of trying to get at the truth. When I posted something about my book online on a skeptic's Facebook page, they got so hysterical. I said, listen, guys, it's 99 cents till April 15th for the Kindle version of God Reconsidered. Why don't you, a couple of you, order it, and I'll refund your dollar if you're not satisfied. Well, when they started to read it, they totally freaked out. The best thing they could come up with is, you don't know how to write. And I said, well, I guess all those 200 magazines that published my 1,600 articles didn't know anything about writing. I mean, the personal attacks were absolutely incredible, but nobody could refute what I had to say. So I'd like to see a little more logical, rational discussion about these things.
Scott, what does religion, mainstream religion, obviously believes in the afterlife? But do you agree with the way they try to teach us that?
Well, the fundamental problem with religions, and I traveled the world talking to Buddhist monks at Sarnath, where Buddha gave his first speech about the meaning of life and the path forward and all that. And I've been in Uzbekistan and Malaysia and a lot of other countries. And you know, I think that it appears that certain spirits have an agenda to influence mortals to believe certain things in religion. And you get the impression that all the seers of different traditions are the blind men feeling the different part of the elephant, that there's some similarities in what they say, but there are also contradictions. And so this is why in the book I felt, and a lot of readers are not going to agree with me, but I felt that you can kind of sort through the likelihood of what's true and what's not, even when you're talking about the nature of the afterlife and the purpose of life and that sort of thing. I think religion's important. I'm perfectly happy if people are content with their current spiritual path. I believe spirituality helps people. Even the atheist best-selling author Sam Harris did a book on religion, or rather spirituality for atheists, namely, you know, have an overarching philosophy of life, kind of like the Stoics did, who were very conservative about afterlife and the cosmos and stuff. But, you know, having an ethical, philosophical system that explains why we're here and gives meaning to life and gives you ethical guidance, that's an important thing for religion, and most religions do a pretty adequate job of it, even if some of us might think they're full of superstition.
All right, well, we're going to come back and take phone calls with you, Scott, as we continue talking about God Reconsidered and the soul of your pet next on Coast to Coast AM.